My Bondage and My Freedom by Frederick Douglass. Chapter 20. Apprenticeship Life. Well, dear reader, I am not, as you may have already inferred, a loser by the general upstir described in the foregoing chapter. The little domestic revolution, notwithstanding the sudden snub it got by the treachery of somebody, I dare not say or think who did not, after all, end so disastrously as when in the iron cage at Easton I conceived it would. The prospect from that point did look about as dark as any that ever cast its gloom over the vision of the anxious, outlooking human spirit. All is well that ends well. My affectionate comrades, Henry and John Harris, are still with Mr. William Friedland. Charles Roberts and Henry Bailey are safe at their homes. I have not, therefore, anything to regret on their account. Their masters have mercifully forgiven them, probably on the ground suggested in the spirited little speech of Mrs. Freeland made to me just before leaving for the jail, namely, that they had been allured into the wicked scheme of making their escape by me, and that, but for me, they would never have dreamed of a thing so shocking. My friends had nothing to regret, either, for while they were watched more closely on account of what had happened, they were doubtless treated more kindly than before, and got new assurances that they would be legally emancipated some day, providing their behavior should make them deserving from that time forward. Not a blow, as I learned, was struck any one of them. As for Master William Freeland, good, unsuspecting soul, he did not believe that we were intending to run away at all. Having given, as he thought, no occasion to his boys to leave him, he could not think it probable that they had entertained a design so grievous. This, however, was not the view taken of the matter by Mas'r Billy, as we used to call the soft-spoken but crafty and resolute Mr. William Hamilton. He had no doubt that the crime had been meditated, and regarding me as the instigator of it, he frankly told Master Thomas that he must remove me from that neighborhood, or he would shoot me down. He would not have one so dangerous as Frederick tampering with his slaves. William Hamilton was not a man whose threat might be safely disregarded. I have no doubt that he would have proved as good as his word had the warning given not been promptly taken. He was furious at the thought of such a piece of high-handed theft as we were about to perpetrate the stealing of our own bodies and souls. The feasibility of the plan, too, could the first steps have been taken, was marvelously plain. Besides, this was a new idea, this use of the bay. Slaves escaping until now had taken to the woods. They had never dreamed of profaning and abusing the waters of the noble Chesapeake by making them the highway from slavery to freedom. Here was a broad road of destruction to slavery which, before, had been looked upon as a wall of security by slaveholders. But Master Billy could not get Mr. Freeland to see matters precisely as he did, nor could he get Master Thomas so excited as he was himself. The latter, I must say it to his credit, showed much humane feeling in his part of the transaction, and atoned for much that had been harsh, cruel, and unreasonable in his former treatment of me and others. His clemency was quite unusual and unlooked for. Cousin Tom told me that while I was in jail, Master Thomas was very unhappy, and that the night before his going up to release me, he had walked the floor nearly all night, evincing great distress, that very tempting offers had been made to him by the negro traders, but he had rejected them all, saying that money could not tempt him to sell me to the far south. All this I can easily believe, for he seemed quite reluctant to send me away at all. He told me that he only consented to do so because of the very strong prejudice against me in the neighborhood, and that he feared for my safety if I remained there. Thus, after 3 years spent in the country, roughing it in the field, and experiencing all sorts of hardships, I was again permitted to return to Baltimore, the very place of all others short of a free state, where I most desired to live. The 3 years spent in the country had made some difference in me and in the household of Master Yu. Little Tommy was no longer Little Tommy, and I was not the slender lad who had left for the eastern shore just 3 years before. The loving relations between me and Mas' Tommy were broken up. He was no longer dependent on me for protection, but felt himself a man, with other and more suitable associates. In childhood, he scarcely considered me inferior to himself, certainly, as good as any other boy with whom he played, but the time had come when his friend must become his slave. So we were cold, and we parted. It was a sad thing to me that, loving each other as we had done, we must now take different roads. To him 1,000 avenues were open. Education had made him acquainted with all the treasures of the world, and liberty had flung open the gates thereunto. But I, who had attended him 7 years, and had watched over him with the care of a big brother, fighting his battles in the street, and shielding him from harm to an extent which had induced his mother to say, "Oh, Tommy is always safe when he is with Freddy," must be confined to a single condition. He could grow and become a man. I could grow, though I could not become a man, but must remain, all my life, a minor, a mere boy. Thomas Auld, Jr., obtained a situation on board the brig Tweed and went to sea. I know not what has become of him. He certainly has my good wishes for his welfare and prosperity. There were few persons to whom I was more sincerely attached than to him, and there are few in the world I would be more pleased to meet. Very soon after I went to Baltimore to live, Master Yu succeeded in getting me hired to Mr. William Gardner, an extensive shipbuilder on Fells Point. I was placed here to learn to caulk, a trade of which I already had some knowledge gained while in Mr. Yu Auld's shipyard when he was a master builder. Gardner's, however, proved a very unfavorable place for the accomplishment of that object. Mr. Gardner was, that season, engaged in building two large man-of-war vessels, professedly for the Mexican government. These vessels were to be launched in the month of July of that year, and, in failure thereof, Mr. G. would forfeit a very considerable sum of money. So, when I entered the shipyard, all was hurry and driving. There were in the yard about 100 men. Of these, about 70 or 80 were regular carpenters, privileged men. Speaking of my condition here, I wrote years ago, and I have now no reason to vary the picture, as follows. There was no time to learn anything. Every man had to do that which he knew how to do. In entering the shipyard, my orders from Mr. Gardner were to do whatever the carpenters commanded me to do. This was placing me at the beck and call of about 75 men. I was to regard all these as masters. Their word was to be my law. My situation was a most trying one. At times I needed a dozen pair of hands. I was called a dozen ways in the space of a single minute. Three or four voices would strike my ear at the same moment. It was, "Fred, come, help me to cant this timber here. Fred, come, carry this timber yonder. Fred, bring that roller here. Fred, go get a fresh can of water. Fred, come, help saw off the end of this timber. Fred, go quick and get the crowbar. Fred, hold on the end of this fall. Fred, go to the blacksmith shop and get a new punch. Hurry, Fred, run and bring me a cold chisel. I say, Fred, bear a hand and get up a fire as quick as lightning under that steam box. Hello, nigger, come turn this grindstone. Come, come, move, move, and bows this timber forward. I say, darkie, blast your eyes, why don't you heat up some pitch? Hallo, 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 three voices at the same time. Come here, go there, hold on where you are. Damn you if you move, I'll knock your brains out. Such, dear reader, is a glance at the school which was mine during the first 8 months of my stay at Baltimore. At the end of the 8 months, Master Yu refused longer to allow me to remain with Mr. Gardner. The circumstance which led to his taking me away was a brutal outrage committed upon me by the white apprentices of the shipyard. The fight was a desperate one, and I came out of it most shockingly mangled. I was cut and bruised in sundry places, and my left eye was nearly knocked out of its socket. The facts leading to this barbarous outrage upon me illustrate a phase of slavery destined to become an important element in the overthrow of the slave system, and I may, therefore, state them with some minuteness. That phase is this: the conflict of slavery with the interests of the white mechanics and laborers of the South. In the country, this conflict is not so apparent, but in cities such as Baltimore, Richmond, New Orleans, Mobile, and so forth, it is seen pretty clearly. The slaveholders, with a craftiness peculiar to themselves, by encouraging the enmity of the poor, laboring white man against the blacks, succeed in making the said white man almost as much a slave as the black slave himself. The difference between the white slave and the black slave is this: the latter belongs to one slaveholder, and the former belongs to all the slaveholders collectively. The white slave has taken from him by indirection what the black slave has taken from him directly and without ceremony. Both are plundered, and by the same plunderers. The slave is robbed by his master of all his earnings above what is required for his bare physical necessities, and the white man is robbed by the slave system of the just results of his labor, because he is flung into competition with a class of laborers who work without wages. The competition and its injurious consequences will one day array the non-slaveholding white people of the slave states against the slave system and make them the most effective workers against the great evil. At present, the slaveholders blind them to this competition by keeping alive their prejudice against the slaves as men, not against them as slaves. They appeal to their pride, often denouncing emancipation as tending to place the white man on an equality with Negroes, and by this means they succeed in drawing off the minds of the poor whites from the real fact that, by the rich slave master, they are already regarded as but a single remove from equality with the slave. The impression is cunningly made that slavery is the only power that can prevent the laboring white man from falling to the level of the slave's poverty and degradation. To make this enmity deep and broad between the slave and the poor white man, the latter is allowed to abuse and whip the former without hindrance. But, as I have suggested, this state of facts prevails mostly in the country. In the city of Baltimore, there are not unfrequent murmurs that educating the slaves to be mechanics may, in the end, give slave masters power to dispense with the services of the poor white man altogether. But, with characteristic dread of offending the slaveholders, these poor white mechanics in Mr. Gardner's shipyard, instead of applying the natural, honest remedy for the apprehended evil, and objecting at once to work there by the side of slaves, made a cowardly attack upon the free colored mechanics, saying they were eating the bread which should be eaten by American freemen, and swearing that they would not work with them. The feeling was, really, against having their labor brought into competition with that of the colored people at all. But it was too much to strike directly at the interest of the slaveholders, and therefore, proving their civility and cowardice, they dealt their blows on the poor colored freedman, and aimed to prevent him from serving himself in the evening of life with the trade with which he had served his master during the more vigorous portion of his days. Had they succeeded in driving the black freeman out of the shipyard, they would have determined also upon the removal of the black slaves. The feeling was very bitter toward all colored people in Baltimore about this time, 1836, and they, free and slave, suffered all manner of insult and wrong. Until a very little while before I went there, white and black ship carpenters worked side by side in the shipyards of Mr. Gardner, Mr. Duncan, Mr. Walter Price, and Mr. Robb. Nobody seemed to see any impropriety in it. To outward seeming, all hands were well satisfied. Some of the blacks were first-rate workmen and were given jobs requiring highest skill. All at once, however, the white carpenters knocked off and swore that they would no longer work on the same stage with free Negroes. Taking advantage of the heavy contract resting upon Mr. Gardner to have the war vessels for Mexico ready to launch in July, and of the difficulty of getting other hands at that season of the year, they swore they would not strike another blow for him unless he would discharge his free colored workmen. Now, although this movement did not extend to me in form, it did reach me in fact. The spirit which it awakened was one of malice and bitterness toward colored people generally, and I suffered with the rest and suffered severely. My fellow apprentices very soon began to feel it to be degrading to work with me. They began to put on high looks and to talk contemptuously and maliciously of the niggers, saying that they would take the country, that they ought to be killed. Encouraged by the cowardly workmen, who, knowing me to be a slave, made no issue with Mr. Gardner about my being there, these young men did their utmost to make it impossible for me to stay. They seldom called me to do anything without coupling the call with a curse, and Edward North, the biggest in everything, rascality included, ventured to strike me, whereupon I picked him up and threw him into the dock. Whenever any of them struck me, I struck back again, regardless of consequences. I could manage any of them singly, and while I could keep them from combining, I succeeded very well. In the conflict which ended my stay at Mr. Gardner's, I was beset by four of them at once, Ned North, Ned Hayes, Bill Stewart, and Tom Humphreys. Two of them were as large as myself, and they came near killing me in broad daylight. The attack was made suddenly and simultaneously. One came in front, armed with a brick. There was one at each side and one behind, and they closed up around me. I was struck on all sides, and while I was attending to those in front, I received a blow on my head from behind, dealt with a heavy handspike. I was completely stunned by the blow and fell heavily on the ground among the timbers. Taking advantage of my fall, they rushed upon me and began to pound me with their fists. I let them lay on for a while after I came to myself with a view of gaining strength. They did me little damage so far, but finally, getting tired of that sport, I gave a sudden surge, and despite their weight, I rose to my hands and knees. Just as I did this, one of their number, I know not which, planted a blow with his boot in my left eye, which, for a time, seemed to have burst my eyeball. When they saw my eye completely closed, my face covered with blood, and I staggering under the stunning blows they had given me, they left me. As soon as I gathered sufficient strength, I picked up the handspike and madly enough attempted to pursue them. But here the carpenters interfered and compelled me to give up my frenzied pursuit. It was impossible to stand against so many. Dear reader, you can hardly believe the statement, but it is true, and therefore I write it down. Not fewer than 50 white men stood by and saw this brutal and shameless outrage committed, and not a man of them all interposed a single word of mercy. There were 4 against 1, and that one's face was beaten and battered most horribly, and no one said, "That is enough." But some cried out, "Kill him! Kill him! Kill the damned nigger! Knock his brains out! He struck a white person!" I mention this inhuman outcry to show the character of the men and the spirit of the times at Gardner's Shipyard and, indeed, in Baltimore generally in 1836. As I look back to this period, I am almost amazed that I was not murdered outright in that shipyard, so murderous was the spirit which prevailed there. On 2 occasions while there I came near losing my life. I was driving bolts in the hold through the keelson with Hayes. In its course the bolt bent. Hayes cursed me and said that it was my blow which bent the bolt. I denied this and charged it upon him. In a fit of rage he seized an adze and darted toward me. I met him with a maul and parried his blow, or I should have then lost my life. A son of old Tom Landman, the latter's double murder I have elsewhere charged upon him, in the spirit of his miserable father, made an assault upon me, but the blow with his maul missed me. After the united assault of North, Stewart, Hayes, and Humphreys, finding that the carpenters were as bitter toward me as the apprentices, and that the latter were probably set on by the former, I found my only chances for life was in flight. I succeeded in getting away without an additional blow. To strike a white man was death by lynch law in Gardner's Shipyard, nor was there much of any other law toward colored people at that time in any other part of Maryland. The whole sentiment of Baltimore was murderous. After making my escape from the shipyard, I went straight home and related the story of the outrage to Master Hugh Auld, and it is due to him to say that his conduct, though he was not a religious man, was every way more humane than that of his brother Thomas when I went to the latter in a somewhat similar plight from the hands of brother Edward Covey. He listened attentively to my narration of the circumstances leading to the ruffianly outrage, and gave many proofs of his strong indignation at what was done. Hugh was a rough but manly-hearted fellow, and at this time his best nature showed itself. The heart of my once almost overkind mistress Sophia was again melted in pity toward me. My puffed-out eye and my scarred and blood-covered face moved the dear lady to tears. She kindly drew a chair by me, and with friendly, consoling words she took water and washed the blood from my face. No mother's hand could have been more tender than hers. She bound up my head and covered my wounded eye with a lean piece of fresh beef. It was almost compensation for the murderous assault and my suffering that it furnished an occasion for the manifestation once more of the originally characteristic kindness of my mistress. Her affectionate heart was not yet dead, though much hardened by time and by circumstances. As for Master Hugh's part, as I have said, he was furious about it, and he gave expression to his fury in the usual forms of speech in that locality. He poured curses on the heads of the whole shipyard company, and swore that he would have satisfaction for the outrage. His indignation was really strong and healthy, but, unfortunately, it resulted from the thought that his rights of property, in my person, had not been respected more than from any sense of the outrage committed on me as a man. I inferred as much as this from the fact that he could himself beat and mangle when it suited him to do so. Bent on having satisfaction, as he said, just as soon as I got a little better, after my bruises, Master Hugh took me to Esquire Watson's office on Bond Street, Fells Point, with a view to procuring the arrest of those who had assaulted me. He related the outrage to the magistrate, as I had related it to him, and seemed to expect that a warrant would at once be issued for the arrest of the lawless ruffians. Mr. Watson heard it all, and instead of drawing up his warrant, he inquired, "Mr. Auld, Who saw this assault of which you speak?
It was done, sir, in the presence of a shipyard full of hands.
Sir, said Watson, I am sorry, but I cannot move in this matter except upon the oath of white witnesses.
But here's the boy. Look at his head and face, said the excited Master Yu. They show what has been done.
But Watson insisted that he was not authorized to do anything unless white witnesses of the transaction would come forward and testify to what had taken place. He could issue no warrant on my word against white persons, and if I had been killed in the presence of 1,000 blacks, their testimony combined would have been insufficient to arrest a single murderer. Master Yu, for once, was compelled to say that this state of things was too bad, and he left the office of the magistrate disgusted. Of course, it was impossible to get any white man to testify against my assailants. The carpenters saw what was done, but the actors were but agents of their malice, and only what the carpenters sanctioned. They had cried with one accord, "Kill the nigger! Kill the nigger!" Even those who may have pitied me, if any such were among them, lacked the moral courage to come and volunteer their evidence. The slightest manifestation of sympathy or justice towards a person of color was denounced as abolitionism, and the name of abolitionist subjected its bearer to frightful liabilities. "Damn abolitionists and kill the niggers" were the watchwords of the foul-mouthed ruffians of those days. Nothing was done, and probably there would not have been anything done had I been killed in the affray. The laws and morals of the Christian city of Baltimore afforded no protection to the sable denizens of that city. Master Yu, on finding he could get no redress for the cruel wrong, withdrew me from the employment of Mr. Gardner and took me into his own family, Mrs. Auld kindly taking care of me and dressing my wounds until they were healed and I was ready to go again to work. While I was on the eastern shore, Master Yu had met with reverses which overthrew his business, and he had given up shipbuilding in his own yard on the city block, and was now acting as foreman of Mr. Walter Price. The best he could now do for me was to take me into Mr. Price's yard and afford me the facilities there for completing the trade which I had begun to learn at Gardner's. Here I rapidly became expert in the use of my caulking tools, and in the course of a single year I was able to command the highest wages paid to journeymen caulkers in Baltimore. The reader will observe that I was now of some pecuniary value to my master. During the busy season, I was bringing $6 and $7 per week. I have sometimes brought him as much as $9 a week, for the wages were $1.50 per day. After learning to caulk, I sought my own employment, made my own contracts, and collected my own earnings, giving Master Yu no trouble in any part of the transactions to which I was a party. Here, then, were better days for the Eastern Shore slave. I was now free from the vexatious assaults of the apprentices at Mr. Gardner's, and free from the perils of plantation life, and once more in a favorable condition to increase my little stock of education, which had been at a dead stand since my removal from Baltimore. I had, on the Eastern Shore, been only a teacher when in company with other slaves, but now there were colored persons who could instruct me. Many of the young caulkers could read, write, and cipher. Some of them had high notions about mental improvement, and the free ones on Fells Point organized what they called the East Baltimore Mental Improvement Society. To this society, notwithstanding, it was intended that only free persons should attach themselves. I was admitted, and was several times assigned a prominent part in its debates. I owe much to the society of these young men. The reader already knows enough of the ill effects of good treatment on a slave to anticipate what was now the case in my improved condition. It was not long before I began to show signs of disquiet with slavery and to look around for means to get out of that condition by the shortest route. I was living among free men and was in all respects equal to them by nature and by attainments. Why should I be a slave? There was no reason why I should be the thrall of any man. Besides, I was now getting, as I have said, $1.50 per day. I contracted for it, worked for it, earned it, collected it. It was paid to me, and it was rightfully my own. And yet, upon every returning Saturday night, this money, my own hard earnings, every cent of it, was demanded of me and taken from me by Master Yu. He did not earn it. He had no hand in earning it. Why, then, should he have it? I owed him nothing.
He had given me no schooling, and I had received from him only my food and raiment, and for these my services were supposed to pay from the first. The right to take my earnings was the right of the robber. He had the power to compel me to give him the fruits of my labor, and this power was his only right in the case. I became more and more dissatisfied with this state of things, and in so becoming, I only gave proof of the same human nature which every reader of this chapter in my life, slaveholder or non-slaveholder, is conscious of possessing. To make a contented slave, you must make a thoughtless one. It is necessary to darken his moral and mental vision, and, as far as possible, to annihilate his power of reason. He must be able to detect no inconsistencies in slavery. The man that takes his earnings must be able to convince him that he has a perfect right to do it. The slave must know no higher law than his master's will. The whole relationship must not only demonstrate to his mind its necessity, but its absolute rightfulness. If there be one crevice through which a single drop can fall, it will certainly rust off the slave's chain. The end of chapter 20 of My Bondage and My Freedom by Frederick Douglass. Read by Rick Kistner for Litigo on the web at fcit.usf.edu.